You might think it's just you, the Chief Justice, but...
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. I've got a number of bills here today that we're going to be taking testimony on. I also have a number of members, as well as other distinguished members here that I need to help try to facilitate. This is the order that we're going to be going this morning. Will be Senate Bill 758. Then we're going to go with Senate Bill 670, followed by Senate Bill 720. How we're going to do this at this point. So let's go ahead and get started with the testimony. We've got some other cleanups, and my understanding is that we have a number of bills that we're still waiting for paperwork. I will tell everyone, anyone that's here for Senate Bill 945, it is not going to be worked today. It will be worked tomorrow. So if you're here for the work session on Senate Bill 945, you do not need to stay because it will not be dealt with today. It will be carried over till tomorrow, which is Tuesday, April 7th. So with that, I'm open for the first public hearing on Senate Bill 758.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 758 comes in from Senator Morris, allows the county to enter an agreement with the Chief Justice of Oregon Supreme Court and the presiding judge of the Circuit Court, in which the county is located, to create a local court facility capital improvement account.
All right, thank you. And I'd like to call up Senator Morris and Chief Justice Domenis and Paul Snyder. Why don't you call ahead and come up and be the third in this group. Maybe we wanted Judy Shiprack. Paul, would you be so kind to come up second? And I apologize. Judy, why don't you come on up? I apologize. I didn't read the fine print here.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Frank Morris, representing District 8 in the Oregon Senate.
Thank you for this opportunity to appear today
regarding Senate Bill 758. I would like to make my comments quite brief, but just as an explanation, I received a call from Linn County Commissioner John Lindsay, and I met with him in his office, and he had a concept which you have now seen embodied in Senate Bill 758. And at his request, I filed this bill. And as you know, we have a long-standing history of court facilities review, beginning, of course, in 2006 with the Ad Hoc Court Facilities Task Force that the Chief Justice initiated, followed by the 2007 House Bill 2331 Interim Committee. And that report was issued in February. What I would offer to you, certainly, is this bill as a vehicle to carry that discussion forward in a way that might initiate a funding mechanism to look at how we are going to address the deficiencies within the facilities, our court facilities in the state. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think as background, I would certainly defer to the Chief Justice and the other guests that we have this morning to speak to this issue. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Judy.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Judy Shiprock. I am a Multnomah County Commissioner, also a former member of the House of Representatives and former member of the House Judiciary Committee, and have had the opportunity to appear in court in Multnomah County as a member of the bar on numerous occasions, and I am here to express Multnomah County's support for this bill. Thanks, Senator Morse, for bringing it forward. I think it's we were almost giddy with excitement on Friday when I walked this around the courthouse, and I was reminded while I was in the Multnomah County Courthouse that of all of the studies and grand jury reports that have been done the grand jurors who have reported annually on the condition of the jails have felt that the jails in Multnomah County are competently run. They don't feel threatened by inmates. They do feel threatened by the physical condition of the facilities. And of all of the studies that have been done during the past 30 years that document the problems of the courthouse jail in Multnomah County, the main concern is seismic conditions, the types of earthquakes, the fact that none of the staircases have fire doors or adequate ventilation, and that the only plan for evacuating inmates from the 7th floor jail in Multnomah County Courthouse would be down the stairs would not be possible if there was a fire in the basement. The stairways would be acting as chimneys. The concerns about the conditions of our courthouse are really overwhelming. The cost to repair or rebuild a courthouse in Multnomah County is huge, and thank you for considering a bill that gives us some optimism that we'll be able to someday accomplish building a new courthouse for Multnomah County.
Good morning, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. I'm Paul DeMunis, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. I want to thank Senator Morris also for introducing this bill, and I would echo his that Commissioner Lindsay contacted me early on with this concept, and I went down to Linn County, actually to the courthouse, and toured the courthouse and met with him about this bill, and I'm here to offer my support. I would like to just briefly touch on two things that I think are important that I want to make sure don't get lost. We did have an interim legislative committee on court facilities, ably chaired by Senator Walker and Representative Nathanson, and Senator Whitsitt was also a very active member of that committee. And they have published a final report in February of 2009. That report makes some final findings and recommendations, and I want to just go through those just very briefly. One is to create a standing committee on court facilities that would create statewide standards for our courts. Number two was create a court facilities capital review board, which would coordinate or review the development of a court facility plan in each county. And three was develop funding alternatives and ownership alternatives. And four, which I think this bill addresses, was to establish a revenue source to pay for county debt service and to help with county debt service and as that would go forward. And this is a start. There's no particular order in which we're going to do these things, but I hope we start doing all of them, and I see this as the first step. This is the first position forward that will take us in what's going to be obviously perhaps a two-decade old project. But it is important to me that we do take this first step. I would also point out that the interim committee tasked the presiding judges and the county commissioners of each court to respond to the statewide study with regard to their particular court facility. Those reports are now coming in, and I think it would be very important that we get those in front of the appropriate legislators so we can start to assess how the local, because each one of these jurisdictions is different, and we have to make sure we go under the concept that one size does not fit all. But having the start, having a revenue source, a dedicated revenue source, is a great beginning, and I welcome that opportunity to work with that group. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for being here this morning.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Just one comment. If the will of the chamber and your committee and your chairmanship is to continue to work on this bill, there was an oversight, I believe, because the role of the local county commissioners is not defined in the bill. It's very clear with respect to the role of the Chief Justice, but the role of county commissioners, and I would ask that we address that issue as we continue discussion on this bill.
All right. We'll do that. Thank you for the insight and update. All right, the other people I have scheduled for today on this bill is it Linda Nodrell and then Paul Snyder.
Thank you, Chair Prezanski. My name is Linda Modrell, Benton County Commissioner. I want to give thanks to Senator Morse, who preceded me here, to testify, and thank you to the committee. And Senator Boquist happens to represent part of Benton County as well, I live in his district. I want to echo some of the sentiments that have been previously voiced. Thank you very much for taking the first step in addressing the issue of financing replacement and or maintenance of existing courthouses. Benton County has the oldest courthouse in the state that has been continuously used for the courts. And this is great. It's a beautiful building. It's an icon for Benton County government. And yet it has some real maintenance issues and eventually would probably have to be replaced. I don't mean torn down, but another facility built for the courts at some point. And the one comment that I would like to make is one that Senator Morse just made, has to do with the responsibility and the authority of the county governments in terms of the portion of the funds that are allocated for local discretion. And so would like to have that added to the bill. It would be a simple addition, I think. We are in charge of the maintenance and the facilities for the courts, and it only makes sense for it to be clear that we would be also responsible for the expenditure of that part of the money that's allocated to the local jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So the expenditure, just to make sure I've got this right and the committee members heard, would be as it currently exists, continue that into the future?
Correct, but this is new money.
Right.
And so the Chief Justice's responsibilities are laid out in Section 4. But there is no section or portion of this bill that says the local government, the local county government, is responsible for that portion that is in the local court facility capital improvement account.
Okay, great. Thank you for the clarification. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I'd also like to point out that Commissioner Modrell is our president, and we're very grateful for her service.
Thank you, Paul.
I'd like to also mention, Mr. Chair, that we discussed Senate Bill 758 briefly last Friday among the county administrators, who made another suggestion, and that was to say that in some counties, since justice court facilities are usually located in a different location than the circuit courts are. Circuit courts are almost always in the county courthouse. Justice courts are often in another town. That often the needs of the justice court are not as great in terms of capital improvements as they are in the circuit court facilities. So in order to provide flexibility, the suggestion was made last week that at the discretion of the county governing body, some of the funds that are available for justice court improvements might be used for the circuit court improvements. So in other words, that creates more flexibility so that if the county is in a situation where the justice courts don't need it as much as the circuit courts do, that the county governing body can shift some of those justice court resources over to the circuit court facilities.
All right. Any questions, comments?
Senator, a comment, Mr. Chair. I did sit on that panel, as you know, and only about 6% of Oregon's court facilities are adequate. Some 42% need renovation, and some 47% need replacement. The requirements change within the counties. with the culture and the economy of the county and their ability to actually fund replacements. Just for an example, $20 million to replace a Lake County courthouse would cost the each of the 7,500 residents of that county about $2,600, $2,700, whereas the cost of replacing the Multnomah County Courthouse, although it's huge, like $230 million, is somewhere in the ballpark of $300 to $400 per resident. So, I mean, it's a moving target, and I think this is a good bill in that it creates some seed money to for the various counties to build on, to create ideas and to address this very needed issue. I know it's a little out of character for me to be supporting a fee bill, but this, I think, is a good one and it's necessary.
All right, great. Thank you. Any other comments and questions? Thank you very much for coming forward today.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 758? Not seeing anyone wanting to come forward, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 758. And at this point, I think what we're going to do is carry this bill over, not go into work session today. So 758 will be carried over till tomorrow for work if we get our fiscal statements and other documentation in place. So 758 carried over till Tuesday, April 7th. With that, we'll go ahead and close that bill out, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which will be on Senate Bill 670.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 670 comes to you from Senator Winters and Senator Cruz. Includes psychologists, providers of adult foster care, or their employees, or physician assistants among the list of private or public officials that must report elderly abuse. There's a dash one amendment that adds physical therapist or occupational therapist to that list.
All right, thank you. Senator Winters, why don't you come up, and I've got a number of different people. John, why don't you come up, sir, and Diana Goodwin. Godwin, excuse me. Put an extra O in there. Shouldn't be doing these things. It's Monday morning. Please forgive me.
Good morning, Chair Fransky and members of the committee, and thank you for hearing Senate Bill 670. I'm State Senator Jackie Winters. I represent District 10, which includes Salem, Monmouth, Independence, and Amsville and Turner. I bring this is really a bill that I bring before you this morning to try to clean up our statutes and to include those professionals who actually are involved with children and the elderly that should be listed as reporters of abuse. As you know, the two groups that probably are the most vulnerable in our society are children and the elderly. And this bill simply adds the list of professionals who come in contact with the elderly and who will have identified abuse, but that abuse has gone unreported. And so it just clearly adds to statutes the nurse practitioners, those that are involved with adult foster care, those who are involved with home health care. Also, it includes us as a body, legislators, and so it helps us to clean up the statutes. In addition to the Dash 1 amendments, and John McCulley will speak to it, his group would also like to be included as reporters on the abuse, and that's when I will turn to John so that he can add to that. But I believe that I became involved with an individual who had dementia and traces of Alzheimer's, and which should have gone reported, and help should have been given, and it wasn't. And I think there's probably more cases out there than not that we don't know about. And to me, I think it's important that we are able to assist the elderly and children when the abuse occurs. And that's basically the intent of the legislation, to expand the professional list that comes in contact with both children and the elderly.
All right, thank you. John?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley. I'm here today representing the Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association and the Occupational Therapy Association of Oregon. Oh, first, I want to let you know we do support the Dash 1 Amendment, which adds occupational therapists to the list of mandatory reporters. But in addition, the Oregon Association or the Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association would like to add speech language pathologists and audiologists to the list as well. When this came to the board meeting of that organization, they were surprised they weren't already included on the list and wanted to be included. Many of those people work in public schools through ESDs or as contractors in school districts. They do come in contact with the children, and it's not clear whether they are included now under the definition of school employee, since they are employees largely of educational service districts or independent contractors working through the district. So we would like that clarified and would request an additional group be included, and that would be speech language pathologists and audiologists.
All right, John, what we'll do is I'm going to ask council to work on getting that drafted, so it'll be another amendment. And I think we're also going to ask to see whether or not the current language would in fact be inclusive, because if it's not, then there may be other groups that may be falling through the cracks as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And Diane.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Diana Godwin. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Physical Therapists in Independent Practice. That is a separate trade group we're not part of Oregon Physical Therapy Association, although we work closely with them. My group is a group of 140 independent practice physical therapy clinics. That is those physical therapists who own their own clinics. I've represented this group for, 25 years, and it came to my attention in late 2007 when one of my physical therapists in a clinic, actually in Eastern Oregon, called me, and he had just learned from one of his adult patients that some serious child abuse was happening in her foster home, but she did not intend to report it because she intended to handle it herself. And the situation was that one foster child was raping another, and he wanted immediately to report it to protect that foster child. And so he called me, because I'm legal counsel to the group, and asked my advice. So I quickly researched the statutes and was very surprised to see that physical therapists were not on the list of mandatory child abuse reporters, although we have always been on the list of mandatory elder abuse reporters. And I believe because the mandatory child abuse reporting statute was enacted earlier, that it was simply an oversight, and that later on when the elder abuse reporting statute was done, physical therapists were naturally included. Now, physical therapists in private practice often work very closely with children if the child is involved in an accident, has had some sort of surgery. They're working with children on rehabilitation. And so when a physical therapist works with a child, they often work with them several times a week for several weeks or months at a time, and they form a very close and trusting relationship with the child, and they're very much in a position to have that child confide in them, or more likely to be physically able to observe any signs of abuse, unlike perhaps a doctor who may see the child only once a year or once every 6 months. So my group wants to take on this responsibility. They also want the protection provided by being a mandatory reporter under the statute. So we're asking you today to support the Dash 1 amendments to Section 3, which would add physical therapists and occupational therapists, and we also support adding speech pathologists. Often, some of my clinics are rehab agencies, and they include both OTs, speech therapists, and PTs, so we would like to do that. And also, the audiologists were fine. Thank you very much. I do have written testimony, which I'll submit.
That'd be great. And Diane, we want to make sure we're clear as to what the Dash 1s will do. The Dash 1s, from my reading and looking at where it would be inserted, would take care of the issue that you have brought before us.
Correct.
And there's nothing else that we would need to do except for the adoption of the Dash 1s, and that would take care of that group for this particular reporting.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Questions, comments from the committee or this panel?
I also want to thank Senator Winters for agreeing to add us in. Thank you.
You bet.
I think it's important that we're consistent, and this will help us to provide some consistency between the abuse reporting to children as well as a reporting of abuse for adults.
Yeah, and they usually seem to, I think our intent has been as a legislature is pretty well mirror both of those, and so we're going to work on this other stuff that John brought up, and we'll figure out where we go from there. Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question perhaps of counsel. This bill also adds the psychiatrist or psychologist privilege issue, apparently on page 2, and it looks like that's applying to the elder abuse, but I can't tell if it also applies to the child abuse. And I'm also a little curious about why there would be a privilege exemption for those two particular fields but not for others.
Mr. Chairman, of the committee, Senator Bonamici, I believe just quickly looking at Section 3 of the bill, that it also includes psychologists among the reporters of child abuse. I think probably the difference is when the bills were created and probably by different committees through the process. So this is not necessarily something that has grown up in tandem with each other.
Mr. Chair,
I'll put on a different hat. John McCulley representing Oregon Psychiatric Association. That statute or that language does appear in the child abuse reporting statute and has been there for some time. The policy being that it was felt that if people are in treatment, if there was not that protection of that privilege, they may not seek treatment and may continue to act out. And so the statute was enacted that way to encourage people to seek treatment and not be a bar to treatment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you for that clarification, John. And so this is just adding it also to the elder abuse section, even though it's already in the child abuse?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I believe that just mirrors the language that currently exists in the child abuse reporting statute.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you all very much. And let's see, Marshall, I have you on here. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 670?
Good morning, Chair Prezanski and members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, here this morning representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants in support of Senate Bill 670. This bill would add to PAs to a list of medical professionals who are required to report abuse of the elderly or children. OSPA believes that it is our professional responsibility to act in a manner that adds to the greatest amount of protection to all our patients, but especially to those who often don't have their own voice. The elderly and young are often voiceless and vulnerable. As PAs, we are their advocates, their voice, and we support the reporting of abuse against these populations. Actually, we support the reporting of abuse against any population, and we thank Senator Cruz and Senator Winters for introducing this legislation. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions from Marshall? Thank you for coming forward. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 670. And do we need to do anything else for 670? We've got amendments, it sounds like.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like we have new sets.
So we're going to just go ahead and close that out, not carry it forward since we got some more work to do on that one. And then at this point, I'm going to go ahead and open up a hearing on Senate Bill 720. Council?
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 720 comes to you from Senator Tepfer. And Senator Boquist Ferrioli allows the custodial parent to move up to and include 200 miles from the non-custodial parent without having to give notice to the other parent in the court of the move. Chairmen of the committee, you also have the dash one of amendments in front of you, which basically modify this and say that a parent must give the other parent reasonable notice of change in residence and provide a copy of the notice to the court when the parent moves to a residence outside of the state that is more than 60 miles further distant from the other parent or moves to a resident in this state that is more than 200 miles further distant from the other parent.
All right, thank you. Senator Tuffler, why don't you come on up, and I believe you want Jeff and Jennifer. Is it Rago?
Rago.
Ragu. Okay. Thank you. If you have testimony, if you just hand it to Courtney. And Senator, when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Prozonski and members of the committee.
I'm Senator Chris Telfer from District 27. It's nice to be here in this very colorful room, unlike mine. But in any case,
we're here to have, you know, the ambiance and the old wing.
Well, it's nice to be here, and I represent a district on the east side of the Cascades, and most of the districts over there, most of the counties over there, have very, very high unemployment. And in these days of high unemployment, I proposed Senate Bill 720 because of input I've gotten from numerous constituents that feel very confined as far as finding jobs over here in the more urban areas. So I'm going to hold my testimony or limit my testimony because I'm going to let Jeff and Jennifer tell their story because I think that's the heart of the issue.
All right. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
If you'll identify yourself with your name on the record and then give us your testimony. Thanks.
Chair Pozanski and committee members, thank you for having me here. My name is Jennifer Rago, and I reside in Bend, Oregon. Two and a half years ago, in September of 06, my children and I were denied the opportunity to move with my husband. He took a job in the Portland area. It was a higher paying job for the city of Portland. To avoid layoffs while working for the city of Bend. The city of Bend has since then laid off over 30 employees. In today's economy, we feel blessed for my husband's job. During this time, our family has suffered many hardships. The additional expense of us living apart, the lack of child support, and my husband's commute every weekend has forced me to work full-time outside of the home, which has taken away from volunteering in their classrooms and being able to be active in their school activities. These changes have put a strain on my children. They now spend many hours a week home alone and have no male role model in their home. We all miss my husband Jeff tremendously, whose relationship has gone from being with the family on a daily basis to every other weekend and phone conversations. My son Austin and Andrew, they are 10 and 12, are both highly energetic and athletic boys. Prior to our family separation, my boys enjoyed evenings and weekends engaging in many different outdoor and sports activities. Jeff was very involved in these activities, taking them to and from practices, games, and working on their skills. Since our separation, this involvement has diminished and been replaced by their grandparents and myself. Today's economy has created hardships for many people. Family unity, love, and security are important in raising tomorrow's future. If the opportunity to provide these things can be obtained for a family, I believe a mom should have the right to do this without giving up custody of her children. I ask that you please support Senate Bill 720 and help reunite our family.
Thank you for your testimony. And Jeff, did you also want to speak?
Yes, sir.
Senator Budowski, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Rago. I'm also from Bend, Oregon. I work in Portland for the city of Portland as a plans examiner. I'd like to thank Senator Telfer for her hard work in presenting this bill as well. I'd like to focus also on what's driving this bill. I think it's the rural areas around the state of Oregon that drive Bill 720. There's not a whole lot of opportunity in our small towns right now, so a lot of people are forced to, you know, have to think about relocating and moving to different areas where jobs can be found. I have done some research, and according to some data released by the Oregon Employment Department, Deschutes County, Jefferson County, and Crook counties posted 12% to 14% seasonal adjusted unemployment rates in January of 2009, where around the state, a seasonal adjusted rate at the same time was posted at 9.9 and a national of 7.6. This, I feel, is a huge number, which makes it really difficult for for families, especially families of situations of divorce, ends up being very difficult for children and blended families. We have become a very mobile society, and I think it's time that some of our laws do kind of come into play and make some changes to keep up with some of our times. And so I'd like to close, you know, saying I support Senate Bill 720 and appreciate support from Mr. Chair and the committee. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jeff, for your testimony. I'm going to open up for questions. And also, Senator, there is a Dash 1 amendment. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that or not. If not...
I have not been advised that there's a Dash 1.
The Dash 1 has actually come from myself and from the committee, and basically what we'd like for you to do is look at it. We don't need to move the bill today if you want some more time. One of the things that we're looking at in these type of situations is that it would be reasonable for notice to be given to the other spouse or the parent of the children. And it has two parameters on there. Basically, if the move was going to require someone to move more than 60 miles out of state, so if they're on a bordering city such as Portland and we're going to move into Washington, Clark County, or if someone was going to move more than 200 miles, that they give notice. And this does not necessarily mean that the parent, other parent has to agree, but we felt that that was one of the things that's important. So I'm going to ask you to think about that. If you want to comment on it today, great. If not, what we can do is carry the bill over and figure out, you know, whether the Dash 1s would be appropriate or not.
Chair Prozonsky, based on your explanation and my quick reading of this, I have no problem with the Dash 1. I think what I'm trying to accomplish here is mobility and being able to move to a reasonable area to find employment.
Right.
So I'm okay with the Dash 1 if you want to move the Dash 1 during this meeting.
Okay. Let me go ahead and open up for questions. And Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for traveling over from Bend for your testimony. The way I'm understanding the way the statute is now, it doesn't say that you can't move. It says that you can't move without giving reasonable notice. And so I wonder if you've been advised or have some understanding about what that means. Were you denied the right to move for some reason? And I wonder, I'm just trying to get a handle on what that reasonable notice provision might mean and what this change would do to the law.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, if I pronounced that correctly.
Close enough.
Thank you. What it basically says is you have to have reasonable notice, and the reasonable notice is to have the other parent the right or the opportunity to request denial or file a status quo with the courts at the time. So I shouldn't say there's not permission or non-permission, but basically it provides each party, including the opposing party, time to file status quo with the courts. I'm not sure if I said that clearly to make you understand, but
I might, Mr. Chair, want to look into this just to make sure that it's accomplishing what they're hoping to accomplish.
And I guess maybe that's what we need to kind of just flesh out a little bit more, because reading the current statute, it does appear pretty much what we would be doing with the Dash 1s is just basically requiring notice to be given.
Correct.
And the change that we have proposed is one that not only would take in for those in-state moves, but also crossing the state border by 60 miles or more. And so I guess at this point, and Jeff, maybe you said this, and Jennifer, it sounds like this may, you know, directly apply to you and your ex. Was there a hearing and did the court rule in this particular case that they were not going to allow you to move from Ben to be with Jeff?
Correct.
All right. So I want to make sure you understand, as Senator Bonamici has pointed out, us passing this bill is not going to change that. So just because we might change this notice here, it does not, at this point, give any basis for the court to be required to allow you to make that move. The court is still going to be, let's say, open to the spouse that might want to contest it, and they would have a hearing, and then that judge, he or she, would make a decision based on the testimony as to whether it was in the best interest of the children to make that move. That's the balancing they normally will do in these type of cases. So we just want to make sure everyone's on the same page as to what would or wouldn't be accomplished with this legislation. Senator.
Chair Polzanski, thank you. My understanding is this, the current 60 miles is a trigger point at which the other parent could request the court deny the move. The trigger point then, in this case, under Senate Bill 720, would be increased to 200 miles, so that, you know, 150 miles from Bend to Portland does not create the trigger point for the subsequent potential of denial.
Yeah, thank you for the clarification that would be within the 200 miles. Jeff.
Mr. Chair and committee, if I may add to that, I feel with this bill here, with the 200 miles, you know, the opposing party can definitely contest it in a court of law, but I feel that what this will do would actually maybe change the burden of proof through the process as well. The courts right now look at everything as the best interest of the children, which I think is a great way of doing it. But as it's set now, it would be, in our situation, our burden to prove it's in the best interest of the children, which is really hard to do in the courts when you're looking at it in a financial situation as well. So I think this is going to allow a little bit of a situation where the opposing party would have to actually show, you know, the opposing side. It would kind of change the burden, you might say.
Did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you.
All right, Senator Dingfelder. All right, the only other thing I wanted to put on the record, and I think we've established a pretty good record, basically we're looking at the in-state number of 60 currently, moving to 200, which would allow for my reading of this, where you would not have to give reasonable notice, and then the other parent would, in fact, still be able to go to court if they chose to do so, and the court's going to make a decision based on whatever criteria they're going to use. All right, any other comments? I have one other person that wanted to give testimony today, so thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I have Charlotte Phillips. And is there anyone else who wanted to testify today on Senate Bill 720? Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Przanski.
There you go.
And senators. My name is Charlotte Phillips, and I'm from Tillamook, Oregon. I am here in support of Senate Bill 720. Under the current law, a custodial parent is only allowed to move 60 miles from the non-custodial parent, while the non-custodial parent has the freedom to live where they choose with no mileage restrictions. I live in a rural area, Tillamook County, and would be limited to Lincoln City, Seaside, and small communities in between if I were looking for work and supporting children. Larger cities have more opportunities for employment and other services. Under the current law, a custodial parent could not move to Portland, Salem, or Eugene, as they would exceed the 60-mile limit. From Bend, currently one of the most economically depressed cities in the state, the options would also exclude Portland, Salem, and Eugene. The custodial parent provides most of the support for their children and yet are limited by the 60-mile requirement in the opportunities to provide that support. Please support Senate Bill 720 and give the custodial parents the freedom to better provide for their children. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for our panel? Thank you very much for coming forward, Ms. Phillips. The chair is going to ask if Ms. Hebb, I was wondering if you'd be so kind to join us. I do have a question for you regarding the dash ones. Have you had an opportunity to look at those?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Sybil Head for the Oregon Law Center, and yes, I did look at the dash ones.
Let me ask you a question because I want to make sure we don't have any what I call unintended consequences. As I mentioned earlier on the record, it was my decision with speaking to council that we wanted to broaden this to the point of where you have on lines 4 and 5, where someone moves a residence outside of the state more than 60 miles further distance than from the other parent. Can you tell us if we might be walking into unintended consequences as to what the rights may already be under state law and within the custodial relationships that a court would already be considering and such?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'll tell you what I think I've gathered from listening to the testimony this morning, which is, and I was just speaking with the senator briefly about this, but in my opinion, the provisions of 107.159, which are what are amended by this bill and the amendments, really just have to do with when is it that a parent is required to give advance notice to the other parent. And that has to do with keeping people informed of where their kids are and whether or not there's an impact of where they are on whatever the parenting time arrangements are. And I think 60 miles, I wasn't around when that initial mileage number was determined, but I think looking at it from a common sense perspective, I think there must have been a determination that more than 60 miles might have an impact on whether you could do a Wednesday night visit or a Saturday morning visit, that kind of thing. And so there was sort of the thought that you would give advance notice if you were making that kind of a change because it would probably impact your parenting time. I think that what I worry about is that this provision, the amendments and the bill, if they were to move forward, we don't have any objection to them, but I'm not sure that they would accomplish the goal of the proponents as I think I understood them. And I think really maybe the better way to address that would be through the modification statutes. And if the proponents, as I understood, were concerned that their need to move with their family was not adequately considered in the judge's determination about whether or not that ought to have a change in result in a change in custody or parenting time, and maybe now, especially given the circumstances economically that we're in, families are, maybe we need to take a look at those statutes and see whether we need to do a better job of understanding the economic decisions that sometimes force moves. Unfortunately, I didn't understand that that was the goal of the bill, and so I haven't given a whole lot of thought to whether or not the how those other statutes would be amended. But I think that the more appropriate way to address the concerns I heard expressed would be at looking at the modification and relocation statutes. I think that's a roundabout way of answering your question, which is I'm not sure that there would be unintended consequences of this, but I'm not sure that it would accomplish the goals of the proponents that I heard.
And I appreciate that. I guess the one thing I'm concerned with, I just want to make certain that we aren't going down the wrong path, is requiring notice when a parent is moving outside of the state. I'm just, since I don't practice in this area, I don't know if the rules already prohibit someone leaving the state without approval of the court or not.
Senator Chair Przanski, members of the committee, no, there's no direct prohibition on that. I do think that there is some, that I know of, there is some, I think, justification for treating those circumstances differently in that if, I mean, part of this is about giving people notice that they can request modifications if they want to. If a child has left the jurisdiction of the state, it sometimes can make it more difficult to pursue a modification and can lead to some jurisdictional questions. Our Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act tries to address those circumstances. But I do think that you might want greater notice if your child was outside the state. So I think that's an appropriate distinction.
All right. I want to go ahead and have Senator Romici ask your question. Senator Telfer, why don't you come back up? I have another point I want to bring up.
I want to ask, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask Sybil, because you heard the Rago's testimony. I wonder if this bill had been in effect and they had moved to Portland and then the non-custodial parent found out and apparently challenged, as is what happened, would that have changed the fact that the family had already moved to Portland? Would that have changed the analysis of modification?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, in my opinion, it would not have. Of course, I can't speak for the court, but generally speaking, modification determinations are based on, number one, a principal assessment of whether or not there's been a change in circumstances. So the fact that if this bill passed, it may be less likely that a court would consider a 200-mile move to be a change in circumstances, which is a preliminary question that has to be answered before they get to the determination of what is in the best interest of the children in the case. But I don't think that it would be determinative of those things, and I wouldn't ever want a change in circumstances to automatically not exist, even if there were a 200-mile move, because, I mean, I think just common sense tells us that could, in fact, have a great impact on a kid's ability to see a parent who lives, you know, more than that distance away. So, and I think, you know, the advance notice provisions of a move more than 60 miles away, I don't actually think that's that burdensome, and frankly, I like the smaller mileage requirement for purposes of the reasonable advance notice, because that can be about, I mean, number one, it's reasonable. I don't think it's, you know, if you have to leave because your mother's ill and you have to go quickly, you know, it wouldn't be reasonable to require much advance notice, but I do think that a move of that distance can have an impact on whether or not, you know, you're going to have time with your son that next Wednesday. And so I think that's what this statute is about, is just making sure that people are understanding what the circumstances are and not so much about what the court's analysis should be in determining a change in custody.
Thank you, Sybil. Mr. Chair, I just want to say I think Senator Telfer raises a really good point, and her constituents have a compelling story. I just want to make sure that we're addressing it the way that's going to be effective.
I would agree with that. Thank you.
All right. So, Senator, one thing I'm looking at here is the relating clause. It's relating to domestic relations, pretty broad. So there is the possibility, if you want to consider having, working with Ms. Hebb, to see if there's some other stuff regarding the modification to add into this bill, we're more than willing to hold the bill for you and an opportunity to do that. And that way, maybe we can flesh this out a little bit more. That doesn't necessarily mean that your constituents are going to be able to get the relief they want, but it sounds to me, based on what I've heard today, maybe there's some loose ends here that need to be tied up and make sure that we actually have the court maybe looking at the issue of this type of move maybe in a different light or in a broader perspective.
Chair Prozonsky, I'm very appreciative of that. In fact, I think that may be a better solution to the situation to look at the modification. So we've spoken a little bit about moving forward and trying to really address the issue, and so we come up with a solution. And I thank you for your time. I thank you for the consideration and looking at this as we work through it.
All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 720. We'll wait till we hear back from Senator Telfer as to what her desires are as to leaving it as the bill is written, possibly with the dash ones, or whether or not we're going to see other suggested amendments to this or other areas of these statutes. With that, we'll close that public hearing. And at this point, Council, how do you want to proceed?
Chair, members of the committee, maybe with Senate Bill 87.
All right, I'm going to open up what's going to be a public, a possible reconsideration and work session on Senate Bill 87. So this will be
Chairman
work
session. Chair, members of the committee, let me explain what's going on here. We had a work session on this bill on March 17th. And Senator Boquist asked me the question, do the amendments fit together? And I said yes, and I double-checked when I went back afterwards. And from a technical viewpoint, they did fit together. But they had, I don't think, and then when I talked to the proponents of the bill, that they had the intent that they originally thought it did. The bill as originally drafted, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, basically added mental health care provider to those provisions in the statute that require physicians and others to report certain information concerning a person's death to the medical examiner. The dash two amendments, in addition to change the term from mental health care provider to health care provider, and then it created some provisions of that with the people providing this information, for example, a mental health care provider or a physician, do not waive any privileges. They supply the information to the medical examiner. The medical examiner, in turn, issues reports. There's a provision in 140 that allows the family, and we added to the family the term sibling, so a brother or sister could get the report. Also, someone who is accused has a wrongful death claim against them or is charged with causing the person's murder in a criminal sense are entitled to receive what is basically background information. In between the Dash 2 and Dash 4 amendments, what happened is we allowed the family and others to get the medical examiner's report. They could get more upon a court order. We then, in the public records provisions of 192.501, allowed anyone showing a public need could also get the medical examiner reports and the backup information that went into that, which would mean information that was privileged information from the doctor or the healthcare provider, whatever. The person that would make that determination would be, if it was county records, it would be the district attorney. If it was state records, it would be the attorney general. When I talked to the people involved in the amendments, that was not their intent. So what we now have in front of us is the Dash 5 amendments, which basically keep the same thing in the waiver, no waiver of privilege. It basically amends the 501 to say that you get medical examiner's report, autopsy report, a laboratory test. And then it also makes additional amendments to 140, which basically gives the family or the person charged with civilly or criminally and causing the death, basically the same information. They can get additional information with a court order.
Okay. All right. So at this point, before the committee, is the, I guess, the possibility of having this being reconsidered in the vote that we pass this out?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And they have to recede from the twos and fours and adopt the fives.
Yeah, so at this point, I guess we need a first motion just to reconsider the vote that we took. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Chair, I move that we reconsider SB 87 for the purpose of discussing the Dash 2 and the Dash 4 amendments.
Senator Boltquist moves that we, let's say, reconsider the vote that we took in passing Senate Bill 87 with the Dash 2s and the Dash 4s. Any discussions? Any objection? So ordered. All right, Council, at this point, I'm assuming we do need a motion if we want to move with the Dash 5s.
That's correct.
And we'll need to amend, or do we need to take out the 2s and 4s in a separate vote, or just in one?
I think you could have one vote to recede from both of them.
So if we had a motion for adopting the 5s and deleting the 2s and 4s, that would do it? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5... That's the right one, right?
Yeah.
The Dash 5 amendment replaced the Dash 2 and 4 amendments previously passed by the committee.
Senator Boltquist moves that we adopt the Dash 5 amendments into Senate Bill 87 and rescind the 2s and the 4s, so only the Dash 5s would be moving forward. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 87 with the Dash 5s is referral to the floor with a 2-pass.
All right, Senator Boltquist moves Senate Bill 87 as amended by the Dash 5s to the floor with a 2-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And who was our carrier previously? Was that me?
You were, Mr. Chair.
I think it was. And the chair will continue to carry this one. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 87. All right, so now we're into the area of work sessions. As I previously mentioned, Senate Bill 945 will be carried over to tomorrow, which is Tuesday, April 7th. And, Council, I know that you said some of the bills, we have amendments, but we may not have the paperwork. So,
Chair, we do have all the paperwork for SJM 12.
All right, let's do that one first. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on SJM 12.
Chairman of the Committee, SJM 12, petitions Congress to enact the tax refund intercept legislation permitting Oregon to obtain tax refunds of persons who owe Oregon court-ordered financial obligations. Chairman, as a member of the committee, may remember the testimony concerning the possibility of collecting $60 million.
All right.
People who owe the state money.
That's correct. Thank you very much. So,
Chair, I give the Senate joint memorial 12 to the floor with a to adopt.
Senator Boquist moves SJM 12 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see, Senator Bonamici, do you want to carry this one?
Would be honored. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And we'll close the work session on SJM 12. And let's go up to Senate Bill 310. And I'll open up the work session on 310.
Senate Bill 310 comes to you from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Requires a person who is responsible for the collection, storage, or retrieval of biological evidence in connection with criminal investigation of murder, manslaughter, 1 and 2, criminal negligent homicide, or sex crime to preserve the evidence. You have the dash 2 amendments in front of you that limit the measure to aggravated murder, murder, manslaughter, 1 and 2, criminal negligent homicide, aggravated vehicular homicide, and sex crimes, and removes the provisions creating the DNA task force. Sets forth sanctions for the custodian of DNA if DNA is destroyed, does not allow the court to reverse the conviction. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Myers is here to further discuss the dash 2 amendments, if you would like.
All right. Before we do that, let's just let's take a moment, Council. My understanding, this is dash 2s is kind of a result of what you and I had spoken about, and also maybe with Ms. Meyer as to limiting the bill, but having a work group that would actually meet during the interim to facilitate how this would play out in on a longer period of time.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I think it would be best to bring up Andrea Meyer
Andrea.
Address the issue. Chairman, as a committee, I did give copies of the amendments to Mr. Campbell and Mr. Powell just before the meeting. They read it and they're not here, so I don't know what that says, but it may mean assent or...
They're pointing at, maybe they're outside working.
They're coordinating
for
their support.
Yeah, too. Andrea.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. And we brought forward Senate Bill 310. I believe it was heard last month. As you may recall, I testified, as did Rebecca Brown from the Innocence Project and Gail Meyer. There was no opposition to the bill, and no one stepped forward. However, before, during, and after, I had various conversations with stakeholders who approached me, and the Dash 2 amendments reflect decisions that we had made, and some of which were in the Dash 1s that I brought forward to the committee on the first day, as well as other requests. So, as I indicated in the Dash 1s, we removed the task force portion of the bill focusing on Section 1. At the request of the Oregon State Police, we made it clear that DNA related to individuals, not birds or fowl or other non-human entities. Per the request of the hospitals and others, we limited custodian, the definition of who has to take care of this. And per the request of the courts in the Dash 2s, we removed the courts from being custodians, although they will continue to have an obligation if and when they have custody of the exhibits, which may or may not include biological evidence. We have greatly limited the type of cases. This is now basically the murder and rape sex crimes rather than, as the original bill was, a full scope of any crime that had biological evidence. In addition, the District Attorneys Association requested that there be a limitation on what would happen if the custodian had not kept the biological evidence, and that is reflected in line 17 through 19 of the Dash 2s, which is that a court may not order the reversal of a conviction under this subsection on the sole grounds that the biological evidence is no longer available. As far as I know, we had addressed every concern brought forward to us. I just received an email from Rebecca Brown from the Innocence Project letting me know she had prepared an email or a memo to provide to all of you indicating that with passage of a preservation bill such as this, Oregon would be eligible for some federal grants, the Kirk Bloodsworth Post-Conviction DNA Testing Assistance Grant Program in 2008. had five states request the funds, five states which received them, and a distribution of almost $7.8 million. There are four programs connected to this to which there is $30 million that's been available. To recap briefly on one other important point, this statute ties into our DNA innocence law that allows persons to, under the same type of criminal sanctions here, rape, sex, assault, crimes, and murder, to seek testing of DNA evidence that's been in the custody and control of the custodian since the crime. However, without a preservation law, we face real significant issues of whether the evidence was retained to be tested. What this does is not only set up practices and policies that will be directed through the Department of Justice, but it has constraints. It allows evidence if it is not huge in bulk. It allows local, smaller, and larger agencies to know what they should retain and what they can get rid of. Obviously, there are issues with evidence and storage and space that are going to arise regardless of this statute. But what we believe is this actually helps put together some important 21st century policies that guide those local jurisdictions with what they can get rid of, what they need to keep, and the process to get rid of evidence as time elapses. We think this is a critical safeguard and next step. We join a number of other states that have already successfully done this, along with the federal government. And we believe this more tailored bill brought to you now under the Dash 2s provides some meaningful steps in taking Oregon in the right direction.
All right. Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Andrew. I just have a question because I have two letters from the Chair's Committee, or Chair's City, the City of Eugene.
I'm actually going to call the representative from the city up.
Because I'd like to...
Adam, why don't you go ahead and come on up.
And I haven't heard from my city on this, but this is the only city I've heard from. I just wanted to know if their concerns have been addressed.
All right.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Przonski, I had been given some indication and on Friday went and got this letter. This letter has never been given to ACLU and there was no testimony during the session and that was the first I heard of it. So I look forward to hearing from Eugene for the first time.
Well, let me preface it this way. Thank you very much for your comments and sidebar. When I look at the March 26th letter, it says that the city opposed SB 310. It did not say that it opposed any of the amendments. So, Adam, has the city / department been able to review any of the amendments that are now before the committee? And do you have a perspective on where the city stands with the Dash 2s?
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Adam Walsh, City of Eugene, have not had a chance to look at the Dash 2 amendments yet, and the letter that you have from March 10th was submitted as written testimony.
It was March 26th. It's from Steve Swenson.
From Captain Swenson. I believe that it's possible that a letter had not been turned in. Like I said, the Dash 2 amendments we've not had a chance to look at yet. I do believe, though, that with the restrictions that have been put forth in the amendments, that it's certainly moving more in the direction of something the city could support. It's not the retention of evidence that we have an objection to. It's simply the parameters that were in the original bill that we took issue with.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
Fiscal. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do not have the fiscal for the bill or for the amendment
right,
for that matter.
So let me ask committee, there's two things we can do. Number one, we can't move the bill for sure. So we can wait. We can adopt the Dash 2s right now. If people want an opportunity to take a moment, meaning a day or so until we get those, then we can look at those and move it forward then, or we can adopt the Dash 2s at this point. So, over.
Mr. Chair, my only question, if we adopt the Dash 2s, then it forces the people downstairs to do the fiscal, right? So we'll have the fiscal at one point.
Chair Przonski, Senator Buckquist, and hopefully on what would be a significantly more constrained, appropriate fiscal in light of the changes from the original bill.
All right. So right now, okay, so why don't we go ahead and do that? That way we'll make sure we get the correct fiscal up, and that will give individuals an opportunity to, weigh in on the Dash 2s if they choose to do so. Also realizing that since this is a Senate bill, it can also have, more discussions on the House side. So with that, the Chair will take a motion on the Dash 2s.
Chair, I move the Dash 2s into the main bill.
Senator Roquist moves the Dash 2s into Senate Bill
310. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And at this point, we're going to go ahead and should we go ahead and keep it moving forward with a carryover, or do you want to just reset it for another day?
Mr. Chair, I would simply carry it over, and maybe I'd like to keep carrying it over and carry it over.
All right. So what I think I'm going to do is, instead of carrying it over till tomorrow, since we're asking for it, I'm going to go ahead and carry this one over till Wednesday. Today is the 7th, if I'm not mistaken, or 6th.
Today's the 6th.
So we will carry this bill, which is Senate Bill 310, over to Wednesday, April 8th.
Chair, if I could ask you about Senate Bill 87, do you wish to carry that over too? And if so, to what day? That's the one that we just did the reconsideration and we adopted the Dash 5 amendments.
Right. Okay, so that's we're in the same position. So we'll do the same thing. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 87 over to Wednesday, April 8th. Thank you, Council. Make sure my notes are here. All right, and so now I'm closing work session, if it's still open, on the 310. Also, whatever work session we had open on 87, and now we're opening up a work session on Senate Bill 389.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 389 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary, and this repeals 137.721, subsection 1. You may remember the discussion we had a little over a week ago on this bill as it relates to House Bill 1087 in clarification in statute about the discrepancy between the two penalties. This further clarifies that if we have a Dash 1 amendment. You may remember the witness from Marion County DA's office who spoke about this particular Katie, I can't pronounce her last name, Suver, S-U-V-E-R. She raised the issue about this conflicting, if there were a higher amount of drugs involved and maybe a conflict, saying this was a lower sentence. And what this says, if a person is convicted of possession of a substantial quantity of a controlled substance, the delivery to a minor, the sentence is not limited by the presumptive 19-month sentence.
All right, Council, we're all kind of looking at our files. You mentioned something I thought about, a Dash 1.
I have a Dash 1 amendment.
So I'm glad you do, but we don't.
I'm sorry. Let me read them to you, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, if I can.
It looks long.
It looks very long, yes. It's
two lines?
It's
counting
on page 1 of the printed bill, line 26. And after the 1, insert, except as provided in ORS 475-900 or section 2 or 3 of chapter 14, Oregon Laws 2008. And they go on to say, in current bill, when the court sentences a person convicted of delivery of methamphetamines under ORS 475-890 or 475-892, the presumptive sentence is 19 months of incarceration unless the rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission prescribe a longer presumptive sentence.
All right.
If the person has two or more previous convictions for any of the combination of the following crimes.
All right, so this is what we got. Looks like the Dash 1s are really hyper-technical as to putting in a couple of statutes. Since one, we don't have that, even though I know we're ready to move forward on this, but more importantly, in this bill, we do not have the fiscal statements.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So we're going to go ahead and close the...
Can I ask Council a question, please, Mr. Chair, before you close this? When I was reviewing this in preparation for this morning, I noticed that the staff measure summary makes it pretty clear that the statute is no longer operative because of Measure 57.
That's correct, Mr.
And it's my understanding that because Measure 57 was passed, then this particular statute that's being repealed is no longer operative.
Last in time, first in right.
Okay.
So Measure 57 was passed after the other provision, so it trumps the earlier provision as it relates to any conflict. That's
kind of like our accounting last in, first out.
Right. Yeah. Right. No, I was a little puzzled because we have a letter in opposition suggesting that we not repeal the statute on policy grounds, and I just wanted clarification that because Measure 57 was passed, that this particular statute is not in effect, and it's more of a technical bill to repeal the statute that's not effective.
You have an advantage over me because I did not receive the letter. All I know is that this is an issue that was brought to our attention by by Josh Naspi of Legislative Counsel's Office and confirmed by Greg Prinz of the Criminal Justice Commission. So I'm under the impression, and in my review, when I went through it, seemed to support that we were simply repealing a statute that really has already been repealed. So we're simply taking it off the books.
All right, so let's since we were talking about a document, this is a memo that's dated March 24th to the committee and staff from Gil Meyer, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, which basically lays out a framework as to their reason to not support SB 389. So, counsel, if you don't have a copy, then I'll give you mine to make a copy. Senator Wissett. Okay,
I'm just listening.
Okay, you had your pen going, or pencil a minute ago. I thought maybe you had a question. Other questions, comments?
Sure.
Yeah. All right, so at this point, what we're going to do is go ahead and close the work session on 389. We'll be coming back to that one, and do want to carry that one over on 389.
Sure.
All right, so we're going to carry this one over to the, let's move this one over to, I'm trying to think what else we got on that one. Yeah, let's go ahead and move this one to Thursday instead of Wednesday. So that's going to be Thursday, April 9th, that we'll have Senate Bill 389 back before us. All right, with that, we'll close the work session on 389, and we're going to go ahead and open up our last work session, which is on House Bill 2275A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2275A comes to you from the Department of Justice, and Margaret Olney and Renil Schenkel are here to add anything on this. Clarifies that a person eligible for and receiving assistance pursuant to Title 4A of the Social Security Act is presumed not able to pay child support. Chair, members of the committee, there was quite a bit of discussion when we had these bills up the last time about the economic downturn. And one of the presumptions for child support is that the person was always able to get a minimum wage job. That's not true now. The Dash 2 amendments allow the Attorney General to declare a period of significant unemployment, allows the support division during a period of significant unemployment to suspend or modify a support enforcement order. Chair, members of the committee, you also have a New York Times article, recent article from March 29th, that this is a national problem right now.
All right. So it sounds like what we would want to do at this point is maybe adopt the Dash 2 so we can get the fiscal on them, because we don't have fiscal, correct?
Chair, members of the committee, yes.
All right. So if we adopt the Dash 2s on 2275A, that will give us the framework to get the fiscal done, then we can bring the bill back at some time in the future.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Let's go ahead.
Maybe Thursday.
Well, I mean, this is a House bill at this point.
Sure.
So I think I'm not going to load it up for this week. I want to make sure we get everything else put aside for a week from today, unless there's a reason that we need to have it before. There is people shaking their heads that we need it before. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll set it for Thursday. Is that a yes? Okay, we got a yes. Senator Boquist, I'll take a motion on the Dash 2s for 2275A.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2s into 2275.
Senator Boquist moves the Dash 2s into House Bill 2275A. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And since we don't have the paperwork at this point, we'll carry over House Bill 2275A as amended by the Dash 2s to a work session this Thursday, which will be April 9th. With that,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes.
Yeah, and that's why we're going to carry it over so they can catch up with us. All right, so that one's going to be closed. But we are going to talk about Friday. We've got two things that we need to cover, members, before we adjourn for today. First, I want to go over the memo. I hope that everyone has received it. It's dated April 2nd. It's to all of us, from myself, regarding the framework as to us getting through the next couple of weeks of work. And so there's, I think, delivered to your office and also within our packet today. So please be aware of those deadlines and the request to give notice where appropriate. So with that, then the other thing is, I think I mentioned to most of you last week individually that we have an opportunity to be participants in a hearing this coming Friday, which is the 10th at 1 p.m. This would be a joint hearing of the judiciary committees, and I believe the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. And the purpose for this is that we have some distinguished individuals that will be in the building that have traveled from abroad testifying regarding some different programs that are available regarding accountability, as some people may call them, reentry programs, and also ones that are being done pre-conviction in the drug arena. The HOPE program out of Hawaii is one of the, presenting topics that we'll hear. So I would like for everyone to look at your schedules and let us know tomorrow if you'd be available for a hearing at 1 p.m. on Friday. The chair plans to be here at this point, and if we can do a full committee meeting, we'll do that. If not, it will be by invitation, so we won't schedule a meeting unless the majority of us can be here. Anyone who has other plans in that afternoon that's already set that can't make changes would be excused from that meeting as well. The other part is in the morning of April 10th. We are currently, I believe, have a committee scheduled without any bills currently, and I just wanted to also ask you to look at your schedules regarding possibility if we need to meet on Friday morning to take care of some Senate judiciary work, your availability to do that. And with that, I guess the last thing, Senator Dingfelder.
I'm just looking at my schedule right now, but the question I had is how long do you anticipate the Joint Judiciary Committee meeting to be on Friday?
I'm guessing it's going to be a couple of hours. My understanding is we have two, if not three, presenters that will be, and it will be kind of like similar to what we've seen during our interim work, and it will be really focused, and it would give you an opportunity to let's have some flexibility in questioning, and with that many people, I can just imagine that it will probably take close to the full 2 hours.
So. Chairman of the committee, this Project HOPE is out of Hawaii. It's had very good results, and I think that we have received stimulus money. I believe we've received stimulus money as it relates to criminal justice issues in the state. Maybe one of the programs with the stimulus money we're going to be funding. It's designed to keep people out of jail through drug treatment and close supervision.
Do you have a location for that?
Yes, that's going to be room 50, which is downstairs in the basement. That was the room that I think they've set aside since it's a very large room for members to be around the dais. Senator Wissett.
Your Friday a.m. meeting, that would be like before 10 o'clock?
Yes, it would be. At this point, I was going to be checking with the president's office to see what the likelihood of us being on the floor that day. I know that Ways and Means normally is meeting their full at 10, and sometimes there's the subs meeting in the morning prior to that, or has that schedule been set?
Yeah, we haven't had any Friday meetings on subs yet, but that's
okay.
To be seen.
Okay. So it looks like we could have our regular start time of 8 to 8:30 as a start time if we need to. I'll work with staff to see how we're shaping up with the Senate bills that we need to be moving forward and those that have not had public hearings. But we will need to know that, and everyone will know by tomorrow because we'll need to post by the end of tomorrow whatever bills we're going to hear if we're going to be hearing anything on Friday. Any other questions, comments? All right, thank you very much. Hope everyone had a good weekend, and we're adjourned.